Welcome to Bonafide HPP, a podcast designed to educate and support the families and caregivers of those affected by hypophosphatasia. As a mother and caregiver, host Deborah Fowler has discussions about this rare genetic bone disease with people from around the world. Join Deborah now as she speaks with this week's guest.
Hi, everyone. I am Aaron Blocker, and I will be your host this week. I'm sitting in for Deb Fowler. I'm a patient and a patient advocate, and we have a very special interview this week. It's with our very own Deborah Fowler.
Hey. so turning the chairs around there.
Yeah, we get to turn the tables this week and talk about you and your journey and connection to hypophosphatasia and all of that. So we'll go and get started. So sure. the first thing I really wanted to ask and kind of go through is just to tell us about yourself, you know, a little bit about your background, your work, your family. I think it's good to get to know you a little more outside of what you do with the kind of the foundation and HPP.
Sure. You know, it's funny because I tell my HPP story so many times. I don't know how many times I've actually been asked to tell my story is, except for like interviews for jobs. But, right. You know, I was actually born in Jersey City. My mom was an elementary school teacher and my father was in dental school at that time. And I grew up in a small rural New Jersey town. And, you know, growing up, I always loved helping people. I wanted to be a doctor. I knew I wanted to do something working with people. And, you know, as I continued to be the daughter of an orthodontist, I always saw my dad and his interaction with patients and his ability to make a positive difference in their lives. And that just really appealed to me. And so when I went to college, my career aspirations were always to be pre-med. You know, I wanted to be a doctor, went to school in a small liberal arts college in upstate New York, and was pursuing pre-med. Either a biology degree or a chemistry degree. I ended up majoring in English because I loved writing, but I minored in biology. And then I did a year after college in New York City at Columbia, where I finished taking two more classes that I had to take before I could apply to med school. And the more I was living in the city and kind of immersed in the working world after college, the more I started to question whether or not I wanted to spend the next, you know, 6 years of my life studying, and is this something I really wanted to do? And since med school is not the kind of thing you say, let me try it for a year and see if I like it, I decided I better try something else before, just to kind of pressure test my decision. I never really thought about doing anything else. And one of my roommates actually said to me, you know, you'd be a really good TV news reporter. I'd never thought about journalism, never thought about being a TV news reporter in the small town I lived in New Jersey. I never even saw a news truck. But it was something that kind of intrigued me. And so I applied for New York Institute of Technology, and they had a broadcast journalism class that you could take. And I went out and commuted out to Long Island and took that class. And I was actually covering stories out there, learning what it would be like to be a journalist, and loved it, and applied for a job, and ended up, started me on my TV news career, where I was a anchor and reporter in Burlington, Vermont, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Dallas, Texas. So I lived in a couple different states following the job, which is kind of how it works in TV news. And when I was in Dallas, I had a terrible shift. I worked from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. And I worked at the Fox affiliate, which meant there wasn't like a morning network show. There wasn't like a Today show or CBS This Morning. So we were live from 5 a.m. until 9 a.m. every morning, you know, covering various beats and stories that happened in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I just said, you know what, this is exhausting. And I think I've done my stint in TV news. And I decided I wanted to get into public relations and found a job in that kind of combined my love of the medical part and the science with the communications piece, and accepted a role at an agency doing healthcare communications. And then after that, I went out on my own and started my own agency, which then turned into Green Room Communications, which is an agency that I'm a managing partner with in the healthcare space for the past 16 years. And, you know, around that same time, gave birth to a son who had HPP. So that kind of started me on the soft bone side of my journey.
That's awesome. I didn't know that you were a news anchor. That's really cool and kind of cool to interesting to see how kind of life works for people. I mean,
yeah.
Going from biology to communications and the news anchoring and the communications, just kind of a cool path that you had there.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, you know, you gave birth to a son who had hypophosphatasia, and which, you know, as people know or don't know, you will now know that, you know, Deborah founded the Soft Bones Foundation, and her kind of connection to hypophosphatasia would be her son. When he was diagnosed with hypophosphatasia, how did that affect you? How did you feel? Kind of how did it motivate you? What was that like?
Yeah, you know, I had never heard about hypophosphatasia. But when my son started having some symptoms that didn't feel quite right to me as a new mom, I did the thing I knew best, which was to research and try to find answers. And, you know, Google, thank God for Google. I was joining forums, and at that time there were like Yahoo email groups that people could join around certain topics. And I was just diving into these disease groups like Ehlers-Danlos, you know, hypophosphatasia. It wasn't a hypophosphatasia group, but there was a Yahoo group. Anything that had symptoms that were related to what I was seeing, early tooth loss. He had very wide wrists, which now in hindsight was the ends of his long bones being flared, which is a sign of HPP.
Right.
And, you know, he had delayed milestones. He was kind of textbook when it comes to the childhood form, you know, was missing milestones, was losing teeth, had low muscle tone, and didn't seem to be getting better with physical therapy. And honestly was in a lot of pain during physical therapy, which was really hard on me as a mom. And, you know, he was finally diagnosed at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He was actually misdiagnosed as having rickets first. And I thought, well, that's weird. I can't believe, you know, he would have a lack of vitamin D. We lived in a, you know, beautiful area. He was outside a lot. You know, I was very conscientious about my diet and I was breastfeeding him. And then he finally started going on to regular food. So it just seemed odd to me that he would have a vitamin D deficiency. And interestingly, in the car ride on the way home from CHOP, which is about an hour and a half from where I live, they got his vitamin D test results back and they came back normal. And that's when I knew he had hypophosphatasia. I had researched enough to make the connection with HPP. And I knew when they told me that his vitamin D levels came back normal, that that's what we were dealing with. And we still had to wait a few days for that confirmation of the alkaline phosphatase assay to come back. But I knew. And so I just immediately went into a mode of, you know, where am I going to get information? And, you know, that's where I just, you know, kind of the journalism skills kicked in.
Right.
And I just was so overwhelmed and devastated and confused about where did this disease come from? And there's just such an overarching sense of hopelessness. And I kind of went into a state of paralysis. I was afraid to touch him because when he was diagnosed, they showed me videos of babies having OI. So I was afraid that I would fracture him by bathing him or by, you know, doing anything that could potentially hurt him. So there was just a lot of, you know, while I wasn't diagnosed as being depressed, I'm sure I was in a state of depression.
Yeah. And, you know, I can imagine how hard that is, not, you know, as a parent, especially going through all of that and then, you know, getting an answer. And while the answer is great, it can even be harder to kind of deal with the
Exactly.
you know, the answer itself and to deal with the disease and the unknown that comes with hypophosphatasia and many rare diseases and chronic illnesses. So I can imagine that was extremely hard, but it sounds like you did a ton of work to get do what you needed to do for your baby at the time.
Yeah, I think it was a very difficult time just because, there really wasn't a lot of resources. So that feeling of being very alone was overwhelming. And I remember asking the doctor, can you connect me with another family? And they said they didn't have another family that they were aware of, which at a major international children's hospital was somewhat discouraging. And, I just kept wondering, am I like the only one in the world or the only one in the US or my state, that has this, and just wanting to connect with another family so strongly.
Right. And that's, you know, and that's what the thing is that you always want to connect with other people, especially when you get a new diagnosis, to we want to see what other people are going through and how what their experience was. And so
Exactly.
it's very important to have that connection, especially when you're living with such a rare disease that it makes you feel alone oftentimes. So from all of that, what motivated you to start Soft Bones, to start the foundation? What was kind of the driving force behind that, and how did that come about?
Yeah, I think that from that feeling of isolation and again, that inherent nature to seek out resources and sources as a journalist, I had Googled, right? What's the resource for, hypophosphatasia? Where's the patient advocacy group? And the only things that would come up was a Wikipedia entry and a couple scientific publications. And that's when I realized that there really wasn't a trusted source from a patient standpoint. And having been working in healthcare and my background, as a journalist, I understood the role that patients can play in research and in drug development, and especially in rare diseases. So, I just couldn't put my head on the pillow at night, hoping and praying that someone was out there doing that work. I knew that as a mom, I had to do that. And, as we continued to learn more about HPP, and I found out that I was a carrier, and my mother was a carrier, my grandmother was a carrier all up the family tree, I just thought, gosh, there's got to be more that we have to do. There's got to be more done for these patients and for my son.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's one thing that's super important is realizing that, you know, that there is a gap out there, and there was a need for patients, and not just for patients as well, but also for yourself and those who are caregivers, and you know, all of the work that's been done, but there's so much more that needs to be done. I think it's one of the it's such a huge motivating factor, and I think that's really awesome that you kind of realize that and move forward. And I know that you've kind of covered this a little bit, but what drives you to continue on? I know that it's not easy to own your own agency and then be a caregiver and have other children as well that you have to deal with and then run a foundation. So what?
You know that firsthand, Aaron.
Right. That I do. I very much do. But what continues to drive you to continue this work with everything else that you have going on?
I think for one thing, we have a very unique experience as a rare disease population to have gone from not having a therapy to having a therapy. We're very fortunate that hypophosphatasia has a treatment. And being along for that journey from a patient and a caregiver standpoint has been so eye-opening to me, especially with the background in healthcare that I have and the role of, what we say on the industry side of things, patient centricity, and what that really means. And I think seeing the value of the patient voice in every step along that way and how it's made such a difference for patients. I think that, patients don't realize that the reason we have those Danby refrigerators is because of the conversations that were had between patients and Alexion at that time.
Right.
Having we talked about, hey, what size do you think the box should be that goes into the refrigerator? And she's like,
Right.
oh my God, the refrigerator is like valuable real estate in our household of, three kids. So that size of that box is important. It can't be super big because there's not a lot of space anyway. And I'm not sure I want to have my, medication that's, priceless next to my, moldy yogurt kind of thing. So we had those discussions, and that's where the birth of that refrigeration program, happened. So I think that those conversations and all of the dialogue that's led to get us where we are today, to have a therapy and have these programs that are here to support the patients and caregivers, is so important. And now we're starting to have similar conversations with academic institutions, researchers, other companies that are looking for potential treatment options in HPP. And that's so promising and hopeful to me because, again, we have a therapy. It's not perfect. How can we continue to refine it? And how can we look at other treatments for patients who can't take the current therapy? So I think that there's just so much energy and momentum and excitement about the future. And that's what really drives me to continue doing the work that we do for not just for Canon, but for myself. I'm starting to have symptoms as I'm getting older, and my brothers are starting to have symptoms as well. So how can we continue not just for one particular segment of our HPP population, but for those who are currently that don't have any choices? Not everybody is a candidate for enzyme replacement therapy. So what other options can we have for them to look at their symptoms and help to treat them so they can feel like they're included in our disease population?
Yeah, and I think what's really important about some what you said is that, and what a lot of people probably don't understand or get to see is that the role that kind of the foundation has outside of supporting patients, and that involves having conversations that may seem odd about the size of the box that the medication comes in the refrigerator or little things like that. But those are things that are done kind of outside of the ropes that a lot of people don't understand. But those are important conversations that affect a lot of people, and just highlights kind of the importance of the stuff that the foundation continues to do and the work that you get to be involved in. And I've been involved in similar work like that, and it is very meaningful and something that's very impactful that you get to be part of. And I definitely understand that part of it, and those conversations just really drive you to continue to do the work that you do.
Yeah. And I
So
think also a lot of times that, we're very fortunate that we have an industry partner that understands the value of that voice, because, I there are companies out there that don't really understand that value of that patient voice. And I think the more that we can tell those stories about the value of the patient voice, the better, because there's, like I said, there's leaders out there that don't really understand what the ROI is from a patient standpoint, and why should they bring the patients in? They think it's more think of it more as a nice to have versus a must have. And it's always been my position that it's not just the easy thing to do, but the smart thing to do, right? It really is a truly a smart business decision, in addition to being an ethical one.
And I think that, one thing that I've always kind of leaned on as well is that, I believe that where decisions are that are being made about patients and that are going to affect patients, the patient should always be included in that. There should always be some sort of patient representative for that, because like you said, that's the right thing to do. It's the ethical thing to do. But also, how are you going to make that long-term impact on patients if you don't know what the patient wants or needs
Exactly.
or goes through every day? So yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of the biggest things, I think, over the last few years that's really been pushed is, like you said, patient centricity in it, and including the patient in that. So I think that that's extremely important.
Yep.
And
Agreed.
one of the other things I wanted to ask is, you've been doing this for a while, but what's one of the most meaningful or impactful things or moment or experience that you've had since starting the foundation?
Yeah, there's one that really stands out to me. There was a night years ago, probably 10 years ago, I was asleep and heard my Messenger ping me at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I looked, and there was a message from a mom who I'd become friendly with online, who lived in Lebanon. And her daughter, 2 or 3 years old at the time, had to develop pneumonia. And as we know in HPP, that's not a great thing with a child. And so she was literally taking pictures of all of her labs and her x-rays and her doctor's notes. And in the notes, it actually said, "We do not have the appropriate medical devices to treat this child." And it
Oh,
was,
man.
I mean, I just remember feeling so helpless. And I called CHOP in Philadelphia. I was trying to figure out how we could arrange to get this little girl to a hospital in Germany or somewhere where they had the ability to treat not just HPP, but a critical patient. And it was like right on Easter morning that I woke up and found out that we had lost this little girl. And it just had such a profound impact on me. And it really lit a fire in my belly for a lot of the work that we do, not just in the US, but around the world, to find those doctors that are treating HPP, that understand the intricacies and complexities of the disease. And, to expedite enzyme replacement therapy is one really important step, but also to connect these patients with doctors who have some sort of familiarity with HPP and understand how fragile these patients can be. And today we have a protocol in place because of that, on how to sound the alarm as soon as a baby's born or as soon as we learn that a mom is expecting, so we can make sure to expedite treatment to these patients, so we can make sure and do our best to ensure that something like this doesn't happen. It's not a perfect science because enzyme replacement therapy isn't available in every country, so it can
Right.
be challenging. But we've had some really wonderful success stories. There was a recent one in India where Strensiq is currently not available, but it just shows that the work that we're doing and the collaboration truly has an impact and can transform lives. And that's a really humbling and rewarding experience.
Yeah, and I know that, as a parent, you and myself can imagine how hard that is to have that conversation with another parent. Just not, I just can't imagine.
There's really, and we've lost children. I mean, there was
Right.
recently a mom in another country that was expecting a child and was trying to get to the US, and she lost her baby 20 something weeks. That was heart-wrenching. And there was another father that was in Baghdad, and he would message me in Arabic, and I would use Google Translate to talk with him, trying to find him a doctor. I mean, it's just stories like that where you're just reaching out anywhere you can to get a lifeline, and to have somebody there who takes the time to that cares and is trying to help you. I mean, that to me, I mean, if I had had somebody like that, I would have been so happy, but there wasn't anybody.
Yeah, right.
So to try to create that network, and like I said, we still have a long way to go, but it's much better than it was.
Just highlights the importance of the work that continues, that needs to be continued, because there are still, unfortunately, children that die from this disease. And
Yes.
I don't think that, a lot of people don't realize that even though there is a treatment, we unfortunately still have children that pass away from this disease. And that's horrible. We need to get to a point where no child loses their life because they don't have access to a treatment.
Yes, agree.
So as we kind of round out this episode, I did want to kind of close with, what's your hope for the future of soft bones in the HPP community? What's your hope for the future?
Gosh, I mean, a big picture, I always say
Right.
I'd love to put ourselves out of business by curing this disease.
Right.
And I think one of the things that's exciting is this is a disease that's caused by a single genetic mutation. And if there is any hope in gene therapy, we're good candidates for that, and I'm very encouraged by that. But breaking that vision down into like a realistic near-term goal, I think we need to better understand what's happening in the body with these low levels of this enzyme. And that means more funding, more research. We know that about half of our patients don't have outright bone manifestations. They may have bone complications or other things that are happening, like, for example, like I had a hip replacement. You know, why am I having a hip replacement at my age? You know, that's a little atypical, but there's things like that that go on, or maybe there's things happening at a microscopic level from a bone standpoint, but there's other things that these patients are dealing with, you know, pain, nerve issues, brain fog, GI issues. We really need to better understand what is actually tied to low alkaline phosphatase, because you know, we call this a bone disease, but you know, it is a metabolic disease as well. And there is alkaline phosphatase in every single cell in our body. So to think that it's only impacting the bone seems a little narrow. And you know, I'd like to really better understand what's happening. So as we're looking again to developing new therapies and bringing that patient-centric approach into it, we're looking at other markers and looking at other things that it's impacting to understand what's causing that underlying mechanism of pain or inflammation or you know, potentially eye issues or skin issues. I mean, you've seen what some of the conversations are online. It's all over the place in terms of what patients experience. So how can we do our best to better understand that so that we can be smart in our research strategy and our path forward with how we're looking at treating this disease more holistically?
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, there's still so much work. There's so much work to be done, and questions that need to be answered. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but there's a lot of good people working on those things. So with that, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit with me today and turn the tables and kind of get your story. I think it's important for the community to hear from you and to get to know you a little better. And as a patient myself, I wanted to thank you personally for the work that you've done and the work that you continue to do and this community. And I think that, you know it or you don't know it, the impact that you and the foundation have had have affected a lot of people. So I think that, I think it's good to sit down and hear from you and get your story. And I think that a lot of people will be very interested to hear about Deborah Fowler and her work kind of outside of the foundation and the work that you continue to do. So thank you for sitting with me today on this special episode of Bonafide HPP.
Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate you as well with all of your followers and all of the advocacy work you've done, not just with HPP, but with your other diseases that you have. And you know, you obviously are a strong voice in that patient-centric conversation. So you know, it's partnerships like this that help us to achieve great things together. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Deb. And I hope everybody enjoyed this week's episode and that you tune in next time.
This has been a production of Bonafide HPP, the official podcast of Soft Bones, the U.S. Hypophosphatasia Foundation. For more information, you can go to www.softbones.org. Or to recommend a guest to be featured on Bonafide HPP, email us at info@softbones.org.